The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
I had a student, amazing, amazing boy. First year that I went to teach, this was in the high school, I don't know, it must be now 11 years ago, and in Israel. When I came to be interviewed for the job, he was, but it was a weird situation because I sort of knew that I was going to get the job, and I was coming to teach, and there was a boy sitting in the same waiting area for the principal who I was going to meet. And it was pretty clear that he was not as enthusiastic about his meeting as I was. Mm-hmm. He was a 10th grader, and it looked to me like he was in a lot of trouble. And I was waiting. The principal was a little late. And so we got into this discussion. And he was what you call in Hebrew a shovav. He was like a wild guy, like a troublemaker. And I like the troublemakers. I have an affinity for them because I was definitely one of them. And so we hit it off. The two of us, we were talking about it. And then I had to go into this meeting, and he was waiting outside. He'd obviously been called to the principal for whatever. And he was a son of Russian Olim, and his name, actually, it's interesting, his name was Dvir. Dvir is a lion cub. And he was very much, you know, you are very much who your name is. Anyways, I went into this meeting, I'm sitting with the principal, we're talking, and at the end of the discussion, I said, by the way, that boy who's sitting out in the lobby, what's his story? He seems like a really nice kid. And so this kind of, like, pained expression fell over the principal's face. He said, yeah, I think we're going to have to expel him from school. He's been making a lot of trouble, and he's causing a lot of problems. And this was like the end of the year. He was finishing his 10th grade year. And I had just been told that I was going to get the 11th graders, and I was going to be their dorm counselor, and I was also going to be their teacher, whatever. And I said, well, would he be one of my boys? So the principal said, yes. So I said, well, I'll tell you what. Why don't you give him to me as a project? Don't kick him out yet if he wants to stay. And wait a month, and we'll have some fun. You know, at least I'll have one boy who I've already met, and we'll see. Anyway, so he stayed in the school, and we really hit it off, and we became very close, and he was like my project. And when he graduated high school, so he went to the army. He spent a year studying in yeshiva in a place called Eli, and then he went to the army. And I want you to know, probably the worst way to find out this kind of news is the way I found this out. I came home one night, I was learning, and I sat down to watch the news, and they flashed his picture across the screen. He had been in Lebanon, and it was a terrible, terrible story. You might remember the story. There were a group of paratroopers that were coming back from a mission. There was another group that was going to a mission, not that dissimilar from what happened, unfortunately, recently. And he was killed by friendly fire. And the whole community, I mean, all of us were crushed, and you don't expect it. And unfortunately, in Israel, you have to go through this all too often, and the loss of potential and the cutting down of youth. Anyway, there was a big tararam after the dust settled, after his funeral. And some of his relatives, some of the other parents of the other two boys who were killed, wanted to start some sort of an inquiry, whatever. And it was pretty clear, given the story, who was responsible. And I'll never forget, the parents of this boy, of Dvir, they said, you know, lama la nishotam? Why punish them? It was on the news. Et ha'onesh shelem kvar kibul. They already got their punishment. Which raises an interesting question. What is punishment? What is the purpose of punishment? How does Judaism view punishment? Is punishment something that I have a responsibility to do in order that I show that I respond to difficult situations? Am I punishing in order to right a wrong? What is punishment? And of course, we understand that punishment comes as a result of crime, of mistake, of wrongdoing. Well, how do I define that? What makes something wrong? And the truth is that what I want to share with you is really one of the fundamental pieces of the puzzle that is human existence. And that this particular issue, you know, we're not going to cover this notion in 40 minutes, but at least the perspective or the direction, I think you'll find everywhere you look. Everywhere you look in Judaism, everywhere you look in human existence. How does punishment work? What does punishment mean? What is crime? Why do I look at people sometimes and perceive that it must be that people are being punished? And I look at other people and I perceive that they're being rewarded. And of course, intellectually, I realize that there's no such thing. There's no way that I can look at someone and and know or assume whether it's punishment or reward. And the line is so thin. Now, if you think about it, where is the first place that we find crime and punishment in the Torah? Pardon? Kain and Hevel, nope.
Adam
Arishon. You happen to be right, because there's a development of the concept with Kain and Hevel, Kain and Abel, that you don't find with Adam and Chava. But certainly the first instance is Adam and Chava. And the reason, by the way, even though I don't like to say a person's wrong, you could say a person's not right. But even though you're not right, you really are right. Because when you really stop to take a look at the story of Adam and Chava, the concept of crime and punishment makes no sense. And I'll give you an example. Hashem comes along and he says to Adam, to Adam and Chava, right? He says, "Mikol eitz hadaat achol tochel." You can eat from any tree in the garden. "Umeitz hadaat tov v'ra," but from the tree of knowledge, good and evil, you can't eat. "Lo tochal mimenu, ki biyom achal mimenu," because on the day you eat from it, motamut, you will die. Right? That's what it says. You can't eat from the tree. Now, by the way, just as an aside, it's a pretty depressing thing that the first thing that Hashem communicates to us is something we can't do, which is very interesting. That's a trap we fall into all too often. But Hashem says you can't eat from this tree. You can eat from any other tree. But you can't eat from this tree. Now, what is... One second. That's true. First he said, "Mikol eitz hadaat achol tochel." First he said, you can eat from any tree. But the first mitzvah, Chazal, the rabbis seem to suggest, is the mitzvah that's given to the first human being, applicable or not applicable to us today is a big discussion, is not to eat from eitz hadaat. Now, it happens to be that the first thing that Hashem says is, you can eat from any tree. And that's an interesting question as well, what that means, but that's really a very different topic. But suffice to say that the first thing Hashem really, I mean, the issue of eating from any tree is within the context of not eating from this tree. Because if I couldn't eat from any tree, it wouldn't make sense that I couldn't eat from this tree. Because then I couldn't eat. So Hashem says, you can eat from any tree, but you can't eat from this one. Why can't you eat from this tree? Because if you eat from this tree, you're going to know the difference between good and evil. Now, we haven't changed that much in 4,000 years. 5,000, almost 6,000 years. If Hashem comes along and tells us not to do something, what do we automatically do? We do it. That's just the way we are. God creates the fish, and he tells the fish, listen, you can swim in the water, but you can't walk around in the desert. It doesn't work. So what do the fish do? They swim in the water, because they're not stupid. God tells the trees, you know, you can grow in the sunlight, but, you know, don't try to live on mountaintops. So they don't. God tells man, don't eat from the tree. What does man do? He says, where is it? That's how we are. So Adam and Chava, through whatever process, eat from the tree. Here's where it gets interesting. Okay? What is the result, the punishment, as it were, for Adam and Chava eating from the tree? What's the punishment? By the way, on this issue, women definitely got the raw end of the deal. No doubt about it. So the woman is told, the etzev tel dibanim, you're going to have pain in childbirth. I would work in the field all day and all night for the rest of my life and not to have to experience that. Baruch Hashem. So women are told, the etzev tel dibanim, pain in childbirth. Man is told, b'zeata pecha tocha lechem. And then, of course, what does God do? He kicks him out of the Garden of Eden, right? So ostensibly, God punishes them. But the truth is, that doesn't make a lot of sense. First of all, if the net result of eating from the tree, whatever that means, is that we'll know the difference between good and evil, then by definition, before we eat from the tree, we don't know the difference between good and evil. So if we don't know the difference between good and evil, why are we responsible for having eaten from the tree? And if we did know the difference between good and evil somehow, then what does it mean that the verse says, "Ki v'yom achalcha mimenu," right? "V'nifkechu einecha," your eyes will be open when you eat from it. You shouldn't eat from the tree because it's the Eitz Hadaat Tovara. You'll know the difference between good and evil. So if I don't know the difference between good and evil, then it's not my fault. Why am I responsible? And if I do know the difference between good and evil, then what's the meaning of that verse? It doesn't make a lot of sense. Second of all, Hashem comes along and tells man, don't eat from the tree. Hashem knows that man is going to eat from the tree because Hashem is Hashem. And if God is to be unlimited, then God knows. So God knows we're going to eat from the tree. So if God knows we're going to eat from the tree, then why is God telling me not to eat from the tree? And why am I responsible for the consequence of eating from the tree? That's very interesting. You know, you tell your child, don't touch the oven. Don't touch the oven. You know your child is going to touch the oven. In fact, you've just ensured that your child will touch the oven by telling them not to touch the oven. So you hope that you're around when the child touches the oven. Let's say the child touches the oven. Do you get mad at your child for touching the oven? How could you get mad at a child for touching an oven? That's a natural occurrence. God created children to want to touch something as fascinating as an oven. So you can fake it. You can play the game because you want them to know that you're responding seriously. You can't really be mad. If you're mad at a three-year-old for making a mess with a chocolate bar, then the issue is not with the three-year-old. The issue is with you. Something's wrong with you. And so intellectually we know you can't be mad. So God can't be upset with Adam and Eve that they ate from the tree, because God created Adam and Eve to eat from the tree, and he knows they can eat from the tree. So then why does God kick them out of the Garden of Eden? So you have to assume that God knows they're going to eat from the tree. That God knows that when they eat from the tree, they're going to get kicked out of the Garden of Eden. And that therefore God created us in the Garden of Eden so that we could get kicked out. Which is pretty depressing. What's the game? In fact, if you look at human existence from that perspective, then everything we go through is all part of this game. The whole issue of crime and punishment, of schar v'onesh, makes no sense. Because that's how we're created. Hashem creates us to go through life, and these are the things that happen to us. So there is no concept of crime and punishment. So if there's no concept of crime and punishment, then what am I doing here? So it gets to be a little confusing. How do I understand this? So I want to tell you two things. And these two things really open the door to a whole different perspective. First of all, I want you to know that the word punishment is not a Jewish word. Judaism doesn't believe in punishment. There is no concept of eternal damnation anywhere in Jewish source. You will not find it. Because eternal damnation, hell, is a Christian idea. I'm not an expert on Catholicism or Christianity. But the very principle of an eternal punishment makes no sense. Because punishment is a vehicle to learning something. If I punish a person eternally, then I haven't done anything. If I kick a boy out of class on the last day of high school, I haven't done anything for him. Maybe I do it for the rest of the class. There's no point to it. If I tell a boy when he's 5 years old, I don't enjoy you in my class, I'm kicking you out of school forever. So no teacher in his right mind would think that there was any value for that boy to such a punishment. So even Gehenna, even the concept of hell, somehow, is a vehicle. What I don't accomplish in this world, somehow Hashem is going to help me out accomplish in the other world, and that's a whole other discussion.
What's current?
Pardon?
What's current?
Karet as well is a very difficult question, but it's not an eternal damnation. So I'm not going to get into what the issue of karet is, that's a very difficult question, but anything in this world, on a divine level, has to be a vehicle to achieving something. And if I cut someone off, so maybe it may be that a person can reach a stage, I mean, you can reach a stage in this world where you've removed your ability to choose two possible outcomes. I'll give you an example. If you look at the story, we're just entering now the story of Mitzrayim in the weekly Torah readings, the story of the Exodus from Egypt. And one of the most difficult questions that the rabbi asks, is that when Moshe is told to bring the Jewish people out of Egypt, so God gets involved. Hashem comes along and says, "Vani chbadati et libo v'et lev avadav, I've hardened his heart." The rabbis, of course, say, wait a second. How can you harden his heart? How can you cause Pharaoh to say, "I won't let them go"? If he's being punished as a result of every stage of not letting the Jewish people go, then how can you do such a thing if he has no choice about letting them go? So some of the rabbis offer a fascinating answer. This is interesting. We choose where we are in this world. But a person can choose the wrong path to such an extent that they actually remove their own freedom of choice. I'll give you a good example. Anyone who's a drug addict, chemical addiction, an alcoholic, at one point made a choice. You can go so far down that road that you remove your ability to choose. Somebody who's a heroin addict and shoots up on a Monday afternoon, it's not that they're choosing. You can't tell such a person. And Baruch Hashem, we're living in an age where the world has finally come to realize that this person doesn't have the ability to choose. The whole process of rehabilitation is to give them back their ability to choose. But a person doesn't have a choice. And because a person doesn't have a choice, you have to assume that a person who's an addict is going to do it. And so you have to remove that possibility, whatever else is going on. So say the commentaries, the Rabban, the Ibn Ezra, that Paro went so far down the path of evil that he actually sunk to such a depth that he no longer had the ability to choose anything else. That's a fascinating discussion. And it brings us back to what's going on here. What is the concept of onesh in Judaism? And in order to understand the concept of onesh, of punishment, I have to understand the concept of chet, of sin. And here too, it's interesting. The Jewish concept of chet is very different from the normal Western Christian concept of sin. The word chet, and you see this by the way in modern Hebrew, means a mistake. L'achti et ha-matara, to miss the mark. If a person is shooting a target range, he misses his target, ichteti, I missed the mark. The concept of chet is to make a mistake, to miss the mark. The best example I can think of, and I know I mentioned this once here at some shiur or other, is Robert Frost's famous poem. Two roads diverged in the woods, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. That was John F. Kennedy's favorite poem. And they read it at his inauguration, and I think what it means is that when we go through life, we're going on a journey. And it's as though, this is the Ramchal, it's as though we're going through a forest. And our goal is to try to get to the other side. And we come to all sorts of different paths and all sorts of turning points. And sometimes I take the right path, and sometimes I make a mistake and I take the wrong path. Well, when I take the wrong path, if I keep walking on that path, I'm never going to get to where I want to go. There's a consequence for taking that wrong turn. The consequence is that if I want to get to the other side of the forest, I have to either retrace my steps or I have to make a left turn. I have to get back on the path. So Judaism says, let's say, for example, that my goal in this world is to attempt to become an ethical human being. Well, if my goal is to become an ethical human being, and that's what allegorically we're calling the other side of the forest, then if I slander my fellow human being, I've taken a wrong turn. There's a consequence to doing that. There's a consequence to speaking Lashon Hara. The consequence is that it's easier to do it the next time. The consequence is that the world becomes a worse place. And if I want to correct that, if I want to get right back on the path, then I have to undo that. I have to retrace my steps. I have to take a left turn. I have to stop where I am and realize where I'm headed. It's interesting, in Judaism there is no concept of jail. You don't find the concept of jail. Because jail, from a Jewish perspective, is meaningless. As a matter of fact, the only time in the Torah, to the best of my knowledge, that you find the concept of jail is when there are 70 prophets, there are 70 elders that are chosen, and there are two additional elders that aren't chosen, Vayehim and Abim b'machaneh, and they're prophesying in the camp, Eldad and Medad, and Yeshua, the helper of Moshe, is very upset, because here are these two fellows, and they're receiving divine prophecy, and he wants to do something, but he doesn't know what to do. So he says, Adoni Moshe Klaim, lock them up. And it's clear that the word lock them up there means, I don't know what to do, but let's stop this, I don't know what to do. Jail means I don't know what to do. What's the Jewish response to theft? It's very simple. You have to give it back. Look, you know what? Since you mentioned that example, and then I'll give you one response, but then I want to get back on track. That's a perfect example. Look at the beginning of Parshat Mishpatim, of the 22nd, I think it is, chapter of Exodus, of Shemot. Of Evan Ivry, of a slave. Jewish concept of a slave is very different from the Western, the Civil War roots concept of a slave. The Talmud says, Kana eved kana rav. A person acquires a slave, he's really acquired a master. The halacha is, Jewish tradition teaches in the Talmud, if you have one pillow in the house, you have to give it to your slave, to your servant. If you have only one meal, you have to give it to your servant. When you acquire a servant, you acquire enormous responsibility. Social rights 3,000 years ago is a mind-boggling thing. And it says in the beginning of Parshat Mishpatim, and by the way, it's interesting, this is such a fundamental issue in Judaism, that this is the first issue that the Torah begins with, right after the giving of the Torah at Sinai. And the Eved, this slave, has the ability to go free. You can only keep him a certain amount of time, because God doesn't want slaves. Hashem says, serve me, don't serve each other. But okay. And so this slave comes along and says, Ahavti et Adoni ve Ishti, I love my master, I love my wife. And it's interesting that the first thing it says that he loves is his master, not his wife. In other words, life is good, it's simple. You don't have to worry about budgeting the bills. You don't have to worry about where your next meal is going to come. Life is good. So there's a whole discussion there. Now, what's the concept of an Eved Ivri? Very simple. Person steals. As an example, person steals. And when he steals, technically speaking, depending on how he steals, what he steals, and how he's caught, or whether he admits, he has to pay back what he stole and the penalty, whatever it might be. What if a person doesn't have the money? What if you don't have the money? You don't put him in jail. What you do is you value this person, you figure how much he's worth, how much his services are worth, and you sell him on the market, and someone actually pays back the person from whom it was stolen, or that person himself. That's a big debate whether you can do that. And if, for example, I stole from you $1,000, so we figure out how many months are worth $1,000 of my time, of my work, and you buy 3 months worth of Benny Friedman and pay him $1,000. And that's an enormous idea, because what that means is that the Torah is telling me, you think you have nothing? You think you have no money? You think you're valueless? I will teach you that you have value. I will teach you that every human being has value. That's an enormous idea. That's the root. But getting back to our topic, so what is chet? Chet is a mistake. I make a mistake. And if I make a mistake, then I have to pay the consequence. There is an obvious and an automatic consequence to every mistake, and that's the meaning of Onesh. That's very important. And it's interesting, by the way, if you look in Sefer Breshit, it's not really that God exiles Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden as a punishment. It's not that God is sitting up there and saying, oh yeah, right? That's not a Jewish idea. It's that somehow the consequence of what Adam and Eve did is that they have to leave the Garden of Eden. And you see this, by the way, in the story of Cain and Abel, of Cain and Hevel. Hashem comes along to Cain. And Hashem says to Cain, Hey, Hevel Achicha, where's your brother? On the face of it, an absurd question, coming from an omnipotent being, right? It's a ridiculous question. So Cain drops the ball. And he says, Ashomer Achi Anochi, am I my brother's keeper? And then they have this whole discussion. You're going to be cursed in this earth. And the Sfatimet, the Ger Rebbe, suggests that what this means is if you could do such a thing, you will find no blessing in this world. You've undermined the meaning of existence. And look what happens next. Cain comes to Hashem and he says, Gadol avoni minaso, my sin, my transgression, is too great to bear. The Rambam, Maimonides, says this is the first stage of tshuva, recognizing you've made a mistake. Hein gerashta oti hayom me'al pnei adama umi panecha esater. You have exiled me from the face of the earth, and from your countenance I will hide. In other words, the automatic consequence of chait, of mistake, is that I distance myself from God. That's very deep. If I make these types of mistakes, it has to distance me from the purpose, from the ultimate reason of why I'm here. And therefore, if I am attempting to rediscover that relationship, I have to somehow respond to the necessary consequence of my actions. Look, for example, at the question that God asks Cain. Ei Hevel Achicha, where's Hevel, your brother? Right? Ridiculous question. But what does that remind you of? What other obvious question was recently asked by God, which is equally absurd? Does anybody know? You know, you're just not thinking of it. Ayeka! Hashem says to Adam and Eve, they're hiding in the garden, which is a ridiculous thing. They eat of the fruit. Vayishmu et kol, and they hear the sound of God walking in the garden, which is a very difficult thing to understand. And they hide. Well, how can you hide from God? It's ridiculous. So we maybe can hide from God because are we sure God is there? Have we developed a relationship with God? But you're Adam and Eve. I mean, he spoke to you yesterday afternoon. Hello? How could you hide from God? Except, of course, that if you've made this type of mistake, you're already hiding from God. The consequence of that mistake is that you're distant from God. And Hashem says to Adam and Chava, Ayeka, where are you? It's not accidental, say the rabbis, that these are the same letters, essentially the same word that we begin the scroll of Lamentations, Eicha, with. Because the question of Eicha, the ultimate abyss that humanity can reach in this world, which leads to the destruction of everything beautiful, begins with that same point of reference, with that same question. Ayeka, where are you? Hashem isn't asking Adam and Chava, where are you? He's saying, where are you? Where are we? Yesterday we were so close, and today we're so far. And Hashem says to Cain, Ei Hevel Achicha, where's your brother? Yesterday you were so close, what's going on? How could you let that go? And by the way, you find this same question in different forms everywhere you look in the Torah. I'll give you one more example. You remember the story of Hagar. Abraham chases Hagar out of the home. He doesn't want to do it. Sarah tells him she should do it. God is very wise. Hashem says, Kol asher tomar sarati shema b'kola. If your wife speaks, you should listen. This is a very healthy thing to learn for all of us gentlemen in the room, right? And Hagar leaves the home of Abraham. And a malach comes, an angel comes. And by the way, everywhere in the Torah that you find an angel, a malach, whatever that means, that's another discussion, it means that there's something wrong. At least on some level, it would appear from Chazal, from the rabbis, that whenever I find an angel, there's something wrong. There's a problem. That's a very healthy thing to realize. I'll give you as an example. If you look at the end of the binding of Isaac, right? So, Abraham is about to sacrifice his son. And all of a sudden, a malach, an angel, comes along and grabs the hand. Al tishlach etcha el hanar. Don't kill the boy, right? Do you ever wonder about that? Why does the angel have to come? Where's God? Why doesn't Hashem just say stop? Pardon? In Achinami, there are a lot of examples of that. But why does the angel come along, and the Meshech Chachmah of Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, and I wouldn't have the audacity to say this if it wasn't that the Meshech Chachmah says it, actually says that Avraham didn't completely succeed. That it wasn't so simple. That Hashem says to Avraham, and again, this is a very complex idea. Rashi says that in the Akedah, in the binding of Isaac, when God comes to Avraham and says to him, take the boy, Kachma at Bincha at Yechidcha Asher Avta, V'ha'aleihu Sham Le'olah, and offer him up as a whole burnt offering. So Rashi, that super commentary in the Torah, says, Lo ne'mar shachteyu elav ha'aleihu. It doesn't say slaughter him, it says offer him up. And the Meshech Chachmah says, actually, Avraham was being used to teach the world a lesson, because Avraham wasn't supposed to try to kill the boy. It's no big challenge. There is one challenge in how you die for God. There is an equal challenge of how you live for God. And you have to really see it there in the Meshech Chachmah. And the Sfat Emet suggests, if I'm quoting correctly, that if you can take a knife and hold it over your son, irrespective, I mean, don't get me wrong here, we do believe that Avraham did something good in the binding of Isaac. It's a very difficult question. But if you can take a knife, for whatever the reasons, and hold it over your son, it affects you. It changes you. There's a consequence to it. Even if it's God, God's self, that's telling you to do it, you pay a price for it. And the price, again, is that there's a distancing. And so there's a malach, there's an angel. And so you go back to Hagar. Hagar runs out of the home of Abraham, and she runs into an angel of God. And what does the angel of God say? Now, understand. Somehow, an angel is God, and yet it's an aspect of God. So that's a very difficult concept, and if anybody ever wants to have a discussion on angels, you can let whoever know, and I'll be glad to come and have a discussion. It's a fascinating topic, what they really are in Torah. But certainly, this is God talking. And if this is God talking, so then God knows. And what does the angel do again? Me'ayin bat, where are you coming from? Va'ana atolech, ana atolchi, and where are you going? Which is the same question. It's like, where are you coming from? I'm an angel, of course I know where you're coming from. It's, where are you coming from? Do you know where you're coming from? You're leaving the home of Abraham. You're running away, even if Sarah and this and that and you're It's the question that I have to ask myself every day. Ayeka, where am I? Ehev alachicha, where's my brother? Me'ayin bati, where am I coming from? Where am I going? What are the consequences of my actions? What are my mistakes? And that's exactly what's going on in the story of Adam and Chava. The story of Adam and Chava, put quite simply, is that Hashem gives them an enormous opportunity. The Ramban says something so deep. He says, it can't be that Adam and Chava don't know the difference between good and evil. If God comes along and tells you, don't eat from the tree, the definition of a relationship with God is that you know, therefore, that you should not eat from the tree. And yet it also can't be, if the consequence of eating from the tree is the knowledge of good and evil, it also can't be that they do know the difference between good and evil before they eat from the tree. So how does he resolve this? So he says something I want you to know. 15 years later, I'm still thinking about this. I can't tell you, I'll tell you what I think of it, but I think this is something we spend our lives thinking about, but it's such an unbelievable idea. He says, before they eat from the tree, they have knowledge of good and evil. After they eat from the tree, they experience good and evil. The whole process of Gan Eden, says the Ramban, is to teach me the experience, the consequence of good and evil. That's why it's the pinnacle, the base point, the framework of the beginning of human existence. And this leads me to one more point. And then I'll quit while I'm hopefully ahead.
How can you know evil without experiencing it?
That's exactly the opposite. No, I have the knowledge that something is told to me that this is right and this is wrong. You know, you come to work, and I imagine that there are all sorts of rights and wrongs that you find out about right at the beginning. What you do and what you don't do, you know? Don't press escape at the wrong moment on your computer screen, you know, whatever it might be, right? There's a difference between knowing something and understanding it and experiencing it. And the value of experiencing it and understanding the consequence. You know, it's not accidental that parents raise their children and make the same mistakes. Every generation makes the same mistakes. Married couples make the same mistakes. That's why there's a business of counseling. And that's because a mistake, until it's appreciated, until it's experienced, is not really fully understood. And yet it is understood. That there's a balance here. But I'll tell you, this leads you to one more perception. And this is so deep. And I think that this gets beyond the definition of chet and onesh, and more to the value of it, to understanding what its place is in the human experience. And I know we must have touched on this, because this comes up any time you discuss Torah. It's part and parcel of everything. And I'll tell you, by the way, that I'm giving you a synopsis of an idea, but if you want to see a good summary of some of these thoughts, there's a book written by a student of Rav Dessler, because this really comes from Rav Dessler, from the Michtav Meliyahu. But there's a student of his called Akiva Tatz, Rabbi Akiva Tatz, who wrote a book called Living Inspired. If you ever saw this book, if you haven't, it's a fascinating book, safer to read. There are really three parts to the human experience. And every aspect of the human experience contains these three parts. There is the beginning, the initial spark of an idea, the gem or the instant of creative power that gives something potential. Then there is the long process in carrying that initial spark into fruition. And then there is the culmination of these two initial stages, which allow the synthesis of them both to an idea. I'll give you an example. You decide you want to write a doctoral thesis. I wonder how many libraries are filled with how many people who have gotten into a doctoral program and are banging their heads against walls trying to come up with a good idea for a doctoral thesis. I mean, that's the first difficult stage. What am I going to write my doctoral thesis about? It's exciting when you have an idea and you're excited about it, but how do you get that idea? So they look and they read and they talk and they can't, and all of a sudden one day, a guy's walking out of a pizza store and he sees a bird and he has this great idea. Oh my God! And he grabs his little tape recorder out and he starts talking the whole way home and he sits down and he writes, and all night he writes. And he comes up with this great idea on 40 pieces of yellow paper that nobody but himself can read. And that's the initial spark, and it's exciting. And you know what? Time flies by. Well, then you gotta take that initial idea. You have to turn it into a doctoral thesis. You have to turn it into a book. That could take months. It could take years. It's an enormous undertaking. And sometimes when you're going through that process, you wonder what that idea was all about. Did you do the right thing? Did you make a mistake? This is crazy. Am I ever going to get there? And then you get to that final stage where you put it together, and it's enormously difficult, this final stage, and you find that finished work. Take the birth of a child. The way that Hashem allows us to create a child in this world is a moment of pure, raw, unadulterated energy, physical and spiritual. Enormous. A man and a woman come together, and if you think about it, the physical process where the seed of a man is placed into a woman is a moment. And it's a moment of intense energy. Fire. Well, and the woman's pregnant, and the child is conceived. Then it takes a while. I remember, especially with, you know, but it's every time, we just had Baruch Hashem, our fourth child. Every time you have a child, I remember the same feeling. When are we going to get there? It's 9 months. And if the guy feels that, I can't even imagine how the wife feels. 9 long months. Sweating in the summer, hot in the winter, new clothes, I mean, you know. And then you get to that final stage. And isn't it interesting that the final preemptor of that final stage is enormous energy? I mean, if you were to come across a birth and you didn't know what a birth was, and you saw a woman in labor, you'd be convinced that this was a disaster. You'd be sure it was over. I mean, she's going to die, chas v'shalom. And you know, the bracha, shelo asani isha, takes on a whole new meaning. And she's screaming and yelling. You know, I made the mistake during our first child's, you know, during the birth, to actually give my wife a piece of advice during labor. Ooh, big mistake. Never again. And it's unbelievable. And then, out of the depths of despair, when you really think it couldn't get any worse, the child is born. And it's incredible to see how this changes everything. In fact, there's almost a tension, a conflict between the first stage, which is tremendous excitement. And how many times do you ask yourself, where is that original excitement? You know, you meet a girl. And the initial stage is so exciting. And she's the one, and dates and romance, it's tremendous. And then comes life. And seems to get in the way. And where's the romance? And where's the excitement? And honey, I'm home, and listen, the laundry's waiting for you. I know already, when I come to America for a week, I know, I spoke to Dorita like an hour ago, and two of the kids are sick, and she's like, I know, payback is waiting for me on Monday afternoon, you know? I left her alone with four kids. So where is it? How do I... And I sometimes think if I could only hang on to that, and you can read books in Barnes & Noble, how I capture and hang on to the romance. Jesus says, no, that's not the point. Because it's that middle process that allows me to reach that final stage, that final fruition, that sitting at your 60th anniversary and realizing what you've accomplished and what you've built, that I can only imagine. And it's interesting, by the way, in the Torah, this is represented by Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Avraham is that initial spark, the energy. He's representative of chesed, of loving kindness, which is an outpouring of energy. He digs wells and they pour out the water. He's the one who discovers God. He's the one who creates monotheism. Kol nefesh asher asa b'charan. Thousands want to flock to him. It's all so exciting. And then Yitzchak never leaves the land of Israel. The one time he thinks about leaving the land of Israel, because Baruch Hu tells him not to. Gur ba'aretz hazot, shchon ba'aretz asher amar lecha. Live in this land. Almost all of what Yitzchak does, he does exactly what his father did. As a matter of fact, the Torah takes pains to tell me that he digs the same wells that have dried up that Avraham dug and re-digs them. And if you really want to know the truth, if you read Yitzchak, he's so boring. I mean, Avraham is so much fun. There's so much going on. Yitzchak, no. What do you know about Yitzchak? One minute he's out in the field. He's looking at Rivka, and she falls off her horse. And the next minute, he's blind and he's dying. That there's so little in between. Nobody knows Yitzchak. Yitzchak is gvura, internal energy. He's avodah. That long process of labor to take what Avraham started and to turn it into the synthesis that will become Yaakov. Yaakov, emet, truth, is the synthesis of both of them. And it's interesting that Yaakov's life, just like the birth, is tumultuous. I mean, Esav, and running to Lavan, and then Lavan wants to kill him, and he runs away from Lavan, and then he finally thinks he's going to settle down, and they sell Yosef. His whole life is one big stir pot. And as a matter of fact, the climax of Yaakov's life is Yosef in Mitzrayim, and their brothers are down there, and it looks like it's all over. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, it really looks like the Jewish people is coming to an end. The goblet's been found in Benjamin's pouch, in Binyamin's pouch, and they're going to sell them all into slavery, and Binyamin is going to stay, and the rabbis say if they go back without Binyamin, Yaakov will die, and it's all over, and it looks terrible. And Yehuda offers himself instead, and this is the destruction of the 12 tribes. And then Ani Yosef Ahud Avichai, from the very vehicle of pain, from the seeming reason and cause for exile, comes the spark of redemption. Yosef. And it's that simple. And it's all wrapped up. Now look closely at what the brothers go through. This is so powerful. Because you see, when the brothers are going through, you know, we think that what's difficult for the brothers was this final process, that they're in Mitzrayim, they don't know what's going on, and the goblet, and they're being sold into slavery, maybe. It's not true. Imagine what it's like to sell your brother into slavery. I mean, could you imagine? How do you wake up the next morning? They get back home and they concoct this whole plan, and they take the ketonet pasim, the coat of many colors, and they dip it in blood, and they come back to Yaakov, vayimma ein lahit nachem. Yaakov refuses to be comforted. Can you imagine what it's like? I mean, many of us have different relationships with our parents. But if our parent is truly in pain, is truly suffering, it causes us to suffer. I mean, it's difficult. My father recently broke his shoulder. It was a classic Three Stooges move. He went flying on a tomato in his office, and he broke his shoulder. And Baruch Hashem, he's going to be fine, he doesn't need an operation, but he was in tremendous pain. I went to visit him. If you have any reasonable relationship with your parent, then your parent broke their... So you feel pain. Do you imagine what it must have been like for the brothers to watch their father in agony day after day, and to know not that they were the cause? Not just that your father slipped on a tomato, but that you put the tomato there, because you thought it was funny. How do you live with that? And they live with this for 20 years. And then, of course, they go down to Egypt because there's a famine. And you see in the verses that they immediately connected to, because how could you not? I mean, imagine if you threw your brother in a pit and you left him there and you never knew what happened to him. I mean, that would haunt you for the rest of your life. And imagine if 20 years later you were in a car accident and all of a sudden, for whatever the reason, you found yourself in a pit. So you would connect the two. You would wonder. You would think about it. You would feel some guilt. So they're back in Egypt. And that whole 22-year process is their punishment. Because if punishment is consequence, the consequence of my mistake, then the consequence of their mistake is that they have taken such a wrong turn that if we're going to create a Jewish people of ethics, then something is dreadfully wrong if brothers can sell their brother into slavery. And so the consequence of their action is that they suffer for 22 years, whatever that means. Now the day that Yosef tells them that he's their brother, I imagine that whole process all of a sudden starts to make sense. And the fact that Yosef chooses to give gifts to Binyamin, and the fact that Binyamin, who was the other son of Rachel, of the beloved mother, is the one in whose knapsack that goblet is found. And so the brothers have this enormous opportunity to blame their difficulties all on Benjamin. And they choose not to do it is really the tikkun, the undoing of their mistake. And that's the process of human existence. In everything, there is that initial spark, that excitement. There is that long, difficult process, that Yitzchak, which follows that Avraham. And then there is ultimately that Yaakov. You know, I went to a wedding this Sunday. We're going to finish in a second. I landed, and it was such a great wedding. It was unbelievable. Because both the Chatan and Kala, the bride and groom, had been students of mine. And this particular girl, this bride, so she came to Israelite to study. And she came not just wanting to learn about Judaism, but really having a very negative perspective, and it was wonderful to see how it changed her, and how much she grew, and how much she learned. And she fell in love with this fellow, and it was wonderful, and he dumped her in the biggest way possible. I mean, she was sure that he was the one. He obviously had different opinions. She went back to America, she was miserable. But, you know, the experience of getting in touch with her Jewish identity and everything else made her decide to come back to Israel. So she came back to Israel and she went to yeshiva and she was really getting into it, whatever that means. I don't have an opinion that everybody's meant to go to yeshiva, but in her case it was really a wonderful experience. And she met a guy, and there's a lot of pressure in the yeshiva world, which I think is a terrible thing. Anyway, she got engaged. And, you know, wonderful, Baruch Hashem, she got engaged. And I was, thought it was a little strange because she was undergoing such change in her life, having come back to study. In a girl's seminary and everything she was going through, it's not usually a healthy time to make more changes in your life. I think gradual is usually the best approach in life, but okay. And then I met the two of them. Like, it was strange to me that they hadn't come by to visit, but I went to another engagement party for somebody else and I saw them. And sometimes you look at a couple and you just know it's right. And sometimes you look at a couple and you just know it's wrong. Here's a girl who's engaged and just wasn't happy. And this guy was like, you know, a yeshiva student for 3-4 years, he was talking about smicha, I mean, he was really all the way deep into the puzzle, and she was way back at the beginning, and it just, something was wrong. But, you know, I don't like to stick my foot in, but it just so happened, if anything ever just so happens in this world, that at the end I happened to have a car, which I never do, and at the end I was leaving and I saw she was still there, because this fellow who she was engaged to had to go back to go to yeshiva, so he left her alone at the party, which is another red alarm bell. And so I said, you know, maybe you could use a ride. So she said, sure. Anyway, we had a 4-hour discussion. I did something I've never done. I never did it before. I hope I never have to do it again. And I said to her, look, you know, maybe I'll burn for this one, but I really think you should think about whether or not you should be marrying this fellow in 6 weeks. You just met him. And I don't have an opinion about quick, long engagements or short engagements. You know, Baruch Hashem, depends on the person. But in your particular situation, you know, I'm not going to tell you you should break it off, but you should really be thinking about this. You don't seem happy. Something's wrong. There are too many issues. You should slow it down. Maybe you should break off your engagement. If you break off your engagement and you get engaged a year later, Baruch Hashem, who cares? All right. Anyway, 3 days later, I got a message that she had broken off her engagement. Baruch Hashem. And it was a big relief because I was really worried about her, but that doesn't mean that you don't have to pick up the pieces. And so she came back to America, and I gave her a call, and, you know, she was in tears. It was very difficult, and, you know, you have to tell all your friends. You broke off the engagement. I said, listen, you know, I have a student, and he was with us this summer, and he's getting back. He knows a lot of people there. You know, give him a call, because I think the two of you would hit it off, and he'll, you know, at least you'll get back into a chevra or whatever, and the truth is he needs somebody to talk to, whatever. Anyway, so this Sunday, the two of them got married. Baruch Hashem. And you look at them, and it's just right. And you stand under a chuppah. What is simcha? That there's so much simcha at a wedding. It's very simple. Simcha, joy, is the point at which I appreciate the process. I can look back and realize what it was all about. You know, you go out with all these different people and it seems so difficult. You meet this person and it's wrong. You meet that person. But the truth is, every person that you met, every girl that I ever dated before I met Dorit, was part of the process that allowed me to appreciate who I was really looking for. And so I wouldn't undo that. You don't say when you get married, I wish I'd met her 4 years earlier. I'm glad I didn't because I'm the better husband for it. The process of breaking your teeth in study is a magnificent process. The process of pregnancy, the process of birth, everything in life that we go through is part of that process. If you ever think that you've arrived at a Yaakov, ask yourself whether you went through a Yitzchak. Sit down one night and write a book. If you didn't have a Yitzchak, you don't really have a Yaakov. At least you don't have the Yaakov you could have. And that seems to be the challenge of life. And so the process of mistake and consequence, the consequence isn't this terrible punishment that's being given me just to get me. The process, the consequence, is a gift. It's also part of that process that allows me to become who I can be, which is the whole reason that we're here. And that seems to be the meaning of everywhere that I look in the Torah, and of the story of the Jewish experience. When you look at Jewish history, you can't begin to imagine how this works. And isn't it interesting, and I don't, far be it from me to comment as to, I think it's very dangerous, by the way, just as an aside, when we look at this idea and we start to define pieces. You know, it doesn't mean that you go through something and say, okay, this is my process to get somewhere. Or this person's going through a process. Or he's suffering because he has to get somewhere. That's not a job in this world. But at least this whole idea and the change in perspective that it must engender is, I think, part of the purpose of being here to begin with. So, Bezrat Hashem, I hope all of us discover a way to get to that Yaakov and revel in the process of Yitzchak that we find ourselves in so often and get lots of little Avram stops along the way. Bezrat Hashem. And thanks for being here and for being willing to listen during the only break you have during your day. And now go back to your Yitzchak.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.